Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 240, and our eyes swivel to the north. The great apostle for Confederation, the pre-scramble for Africa, political omelette, and free state ships. Part of the story is a continuation of the Langalibalele affair in Natal, which had created the perception that the authorities there were unable to cope. This provided an opportunity for colonial office officials back in England to consider radical moves like forcing through a confederation of South African colonies and perhaps even the republics. Throughout the 1870s, Lord Carnarvon, the British Secretary of State for the colonies, attempted to unite both the colonies and the Boer republics into a self-governing settler, self-governing dominion under the British flag. This was a somewhat grandiose scheme, and there's a heady debate amongst historians about why Carnarvon tried to do this. We're going to take a closer look at what was going on internationally and how South Africa factored into this global picture, because it's part of the story. The concept of a confederated South Africa was obviously opposed by the Boer republics. More significantly, it was also opposed by the Maltino administration of the Cape Colony, which was the biggest and the richest South African state by far. Liberal humanist historians believe Carnarvon wanted confederation to protect blacks from the colonials, but that's a rather shallow version of the actual events. It was in Natal where the largest portion of the white population favoured confederation, but even there, Lieutenant Governor Chili Pine described an apathy and indifference to the policy by some. John X. Merriman, who was a member of Maltino's cabinet, said, "The fact is that the cry for confederation is purely an extraneous one, born in the brain of Lord Carnarvon, local prejudice and local jealousy tending the other way." Maltino and his Merriman were focused on infrastructure. Work had begun on the Cape Parliamentary buildings in 1874. Government funding of education was legislated, and the Maltino government also established the South African Public Library System. Nevertheless, in other circles in South Africa, the call for federation was growing. Take the merchants of Port Elizabeth and a large section of the English-speaking Natalians, for example. With regard to the Port Elizabethans, the Easterners, as they were known, it was as a matter of being dominated by Western-based politicians, Western as in Western Cape, just for clarification. Natal had yet to receive responsible government, unlike the Cape. Given the various political currents surging around the region, why did Carnarvon pursue the idea of confederation so aggressively when it was so unlikely? Let's dive in. Theophilus Shepston could be one reason. The veteran of Natal's native affairs had met Carnarvon and converted him to what historian R.L. Cope calls an instrument of the sub-imperialist forces emanating from Natal. There was a paradox here. The tiny white minority of Natal was fearful of the black majority and therefore harbored impulses to bring further tracts of African territory under British control. It was this demographic imbalance that drove the colonials' voice, but it was a contradictory position for any imperial government to take. Why support a tiny group, unlike in the Cape, which had a vibrant economy and was dominated by settler interests, both financially and demographically? For Natalians, the perpetual labour shortage seemed insurmountable. Maybe a forced union of some sort would open up other colonies where their labour could be exploited. Shepston was a leading figure in the expansionist policy movement, meeting Carnarvon shortly after the Langalibalele affair in 1874, when the Natal official spent 3 months in England. Shepston reportedly had an immediate and significant effect on Carnarvon. Others, like Shepston's border agent Frederick Elton, were also there and muttering in the colonial secretary's ear. There's no hint of some dark conspiracy, folks. It was the sign of the times. Shepston's policy of allowing the tribal system and what he called native law to continue as methods of control was actually totally opposite Carnarvon's idea of how Natal should be run, or any colony for that matter. The lesson that the colonial office drew from the Langalibalele affair was that the tribal system and native law should be phased out, and that Africans should be Europeanized, or civilized, as he put it. Incorporate them into society, he said. Don't put them in reservations or locations or force them to migrate from these locations to the towns for work. Don't separate them, incorporate them. The farms were reliant on other isiZulu traveling from the north, Zululand, as well. The more people integrated, the happier they'd become, said Carnarvon. Shepston, on the other hand, demurred, telling Carnarvon that customary law was a safety valve. Co-opt the chiefs, reward them handsomely, then they will carry out your wishes. This was known as the Shepston system. Carnarvon pointed out that if the farm owners paid black workers better wages and treated them more fairly, perhaps foreign labour wouldn't be required, and more of the black citizens around Natal would agree to work, rendering his system unworkable. Shepston was careful not to explicitly disagree with his boss, so he offered to institute a new policy when he returned home, which, despite all the promises, remained the old policy. With both Carnarvon and Shepston believing in confederation, trifling over black labour appeared to be the least of their challenges. Furthermore, in Port Elizabeth, a powerful voice supporting their position was already developing rapidly, and he had cash to burn. That was the founder of the Standard Bank, John Paterson. As a leading Port Elizabeth merchant, the Cape Argus described him as a great apostle of confederation. Just as Shepston represented the expansionist policies of Natal, Paterson represented the expansionist policies of the Eastern Cape. Remarkably, particularly in these days where the Nelson Mandela Bay municipality is a dilapidated, nefarious, ransacked skeleton of its former self, a veritable playground for the underwhelming, incapacitated, deployed political class, back in the 1870s, it was Port Elizabeth and not Cape Town that was the commercial metropolis of the Cape. In the 1850s, the value of goods passing through both ports was equal. By the 1870s, Port Elizabeth's share was more than double that of Cape Town's, partly because of the wool trade, as you've heard, but also the result of the Eastern Cape's port being closer to the diamond fields and because it had a greater role when it came to trade with the interior of South Africa. Cape Town was further away from where growth was most pronounced. This was also before the railway line was completed from Cape Town to Kimberley, and instead of coal-driving locomotives, it was grass that fueled oxen. Separating the interior of South Africa from Cape Town was extremely arid countryside, which created transport problems, denuded of grass and water for much of the year. PE was much closer, and travellers could avoid the Karoo. A syndicate of Port Elizabeth merchants, including Paterson, owned the farm in which the Kimberley and De Beers mines were situated. Not only did they dominate trade with the region, these merchants dominated the diamond fields themselves. It was these Port Elizabeth merchants who urged Sir Henry Barclay to annex Griqualand West on behalf of the British. Once that happened, the merchants pitched up and set to work, raising rents and license fees for the diggers, forcing the independent operators into a financial corner, thus opening a door for themselves, the old property trick, a form of corporate gentrification. Barclay warned the merchants that he was not going to employ British bayonets to make their fortunes. Double irony then, because the British were going to do just that. They marched in to quell a digger rebellion, and later hundreds of thousands of British troops arrived in South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War, a war that was caused partly and massaged by the financial interests of British-linked South African miners like Cecil John Rhodes. The merchants and bankers and miners were going to employ British bayonets to make their fortunes. By the mid-1870s, the Transvaal Boers owed more than £1 million to the Eastern Cape merchants, and these same merchants were going to celebrate a few years' time in 1877 when Britain annexed the Transvaal. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. As you can well imagine, all these pressure groups believed in a confederated South Africa for their own interests. They were joined by another, Donald Curry, who owned the Castle Shipping Line. Up until the 1870s, the Union Shipping Line had monopolized the regular sailings between England and South Africa, but Curry had broken this monopoly and was a font of intelligence about Boer plans for a railway between Pretoria and the Portuguese at Delagoa Bay. The intersection between empire and useful capitalist is no coincidence. Carnarvon and the Confederates wanted to solve the dispute over the diamond fields. The merchants' complaints, though, being hampered in their surge inland by the Boer republics and the obvious instability of Natal. Annexation followed by confederation appeared to be the most likely path to stability. Each of these colonies and republics operated independently. There was no unity between the Eastern Capers and Western Capers, nor between these two and the Natalians. There was friction and bitterness between the Boer republics and the three English colonies, and it was going to take two bloody wars before any sort of federation slash union took place. Stepping back from South Africa, what is imperative at this time was what was going on further afield. Similar to the pressures of today's geopolitical landscape, in the 1870s, empires were colliding, and South Africa was a strategic location. Britain, in the latter half of the 19th century, the apex, supposedly, of Victorian England, was ascendant, but its position was being threatened by a rapidly developing United States and other European nations. The period of rampant expansionism had actually cooled for Great Britain, and within the home country, the political tide had changed. It was generally assumed that the colonies of settlement across the world, the Canadians, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, India, would eventually become independent. Far from this process being resisted, self-government was preferred. When these colonies attained self-government, they would therefore attain self-defense. The high cost of military support for each would drop, theoretically. The political party dominant in England in the 1870s were the Liberals, who strongly supported that line of thought. Yes, the empire was a source of pride for most Englishmen and women, but many felt that everything of value in this global village of Anglo-Saxon nations that survived an amicable parting, a move to self-government and independence, deserved to. Those that failed following independence did not deserve the Anglo-Saxon connection in the first place, a kind of social Darwinian liberal philosophy. Those that failed, was the thinking, didn't deserve being part of the empire anyway. 1870 was one of those epochal moments in global history. If you remember, it was when the Franco-Prussian War began, but it was also the year that British troops withdrew from New Zealand, which didn't collapse, and thus the English Liberal Party's view that they were deserved of self-government. Prime Minister William Gladstone was a Liberal, and he was being accused by imperialists of trying to dismember the British Empire. A number of noisy nationalist protests were held in London by colonists and ex-colonists and Englishmen with colonial connections, a bit like what's going on at the moment. The Conservative Party's narrative of the time was that while they supported self-government, their system, not the Liberals, would bind the semi-independent colonies closer to the mother country. Benjamin Disraeli, who led the Conservatives, put it this way. Self-government should have been granted as part of a great policy of imperial consolidation. The proposals he laid out were typical of any politician, vague, and included the alarming phrase rolled out by all imperial nationalists, as well as an imperial tariff. Carnarvon was a civil servant and had little faith in his politicians' blueprints, muddle-headed and opaque as they appeared. When he did introduce the South African Confederation Bill in 1878, he believed the Confederation would lead to union. He was right about the union bit, but completely wrong about Confederation. But I digress. We're still in the first half of the 1870s, and global events were shaking up planet Earth. The balance of power in Europe was changing. The Franco-Prussian War ended on May 10, 1871, with the signing of the Treaty of Frankfurt. From the crucible of three swift successive wars against Denmark, Austria, and France, a new power had emerged, not as a tentative collection of states, but as a thundering unified entity. In the wake of these brutal conflicts, as the smoke of battle cleared and the vestiges of the old European order lay in ruin, the German Empire was formally proclaimed. This was more than a mere political reshuffling. It was the birth of a titan. With its strength forged in the fire of their military victory and its purpose hardened by the iron will of Otto von Bismarck, this new nation stood poised to take its place on the world stage. The victories over Denmark in 1864 and Austria in 1866 paved the way, but it was the decisive Franco-Prussian War, 1870-71, that served as the final binding mortar. The Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, a symbol of French imperial might, became the backdrop for the proclamation of Kaiser Wilhelm I as Emperor of a united Germany. This act was a deliberate, pointed statement. A new center of power had risen in the heart of Europe. This new German empire, with its industrial might and its formidable military, was not content to remain a passive player. It possessed the restless energy and deep-seated ambition that would propel it to the forefront of global events. In the decades that followed, this empire would embark on a course of history that was as ambitious as it was ultimately tragic. After the Franco-Prussian War, Russia seized upon the defeat of France to tear up the clauses of the Treaty of Paris imposed on her by the English and the French during the Crimean War. Russia declared the neutrality of the Black Sea was no longer her policy. She would control the water as Russia. It's curious how history plays out in cycles. Russia would go on to seize the Crimea, give it back to Ukraine, seize it again in 2014 under its new Tsar, Vladimir Putin. Whatever happens post-Ukraine invasion by Moscow, it's unlikely Crimea will be handed back. In England, the Liberal government under Gladstone found itself facing accusations of a peace-at-any-price principle after Russia's belligerent action. A doctrine of non-intervention, said the Conservatives, caused the effacement of England. Embarrassing, said the imperialists in London. Carnarvon called this appeasement of Russia not only dishonourable, but downright dangerous. It suddenly occurred to all watching this that Britain's era of undisputed supremacy in economic matters and diplomatic was drawing to a close. The British had been aloof through the last half century in particular and had tended towards pacifism and complacency. Its commanding lead in industry was now being challenged. It was the economy that flagged the sagging midriff of empire, this midlife crisis. In the late 1860s, Britain had experienced a short, sharp depression, but that depression returned in 1873 in spades. It was pronounced throughout Europe and America. It was prolonged, and the turning point was only to come in 1879. British overseas investment collapsed from £73 million per annum in 1873 to £28 million by 1878. Prices of exports rose by a measly 3% in the 1870s, compared to the previous few decades of price rises of over 15%. And because prices fell, the actual value of exports fell by 18% between 1872 and 1879. This period would come to be known as the Great Depression of 1873 by economists. At the same time, Britain ceased to be the workshop of the world, overtaken by the United States as the main industrial power on the planet. Germany's economic growth overtook Great Britain's. The new German Empire was indeed finding its place in the sun. British merchants began to pursue overseas markets more consistently. Since the industrialized countries were excluding each other's goods to a large extent because of tariffs, the search turned outwards to the world outside Europe, the unindustrialized world. This was going to become known as the Scramble for Africa, which is generally recorded as having begun in earnest in the 1880s. But as we've heard, the combustible materials for this scramble began in the 1870s. Coming soon to a convention centre at Brussels, an annual conference lauded over by King Leopold of Belgium, who was pressing for an international association that would oversee the African colonies on behalf of the Europeans. A chilling suggestion, one which even at the time had many pondering the legality of one continent trying to subjugate the other. So many things were unknown. Back in South Africa, there was an immediate effect of all these economic, financial, and political gusts. In the 1870s, British annual exports to South Africa grew fourfold to £7.5 million, while the exports plunged elsewhere. While previously the trade cycle between these two territories had corresponded, they began to diverge in the 1870s. Britain plunged into a depression, but it was boom time in South Africa. Thus, two main themes emerged in British politics when it came to South Africa through the 1870s. First was the fear of exclusion from Africa generally, and secondly was the need to consolidate the colonial settlements, to federate, and then a new large stable South Africa could buy British stuff. Unlike the rest of Africa, South Africa consisted of colonies of British settlers. More of it was occupied by the Boer republics and by African chiefs, and in the eyes of the British, this lack of unity hampered development and profit. The interior seemed to hold out promise of the greatest development, and this was the area dominated by the African chiefs and the Boers. The colonial office believed these people had no rights under what they called international law and believed that Britain had the right to annex any land they felt like. Obviously, it wasn't only Britain. King Leopold of Belgium is probably the most studied. Historians categorize him not just as a cruel ruler, but as a master of deception who cultivated a humanitarian image while privately orchestrating one of the most brutal regimes in modern history. The overriding narrative of Europe's right to anything African extended to the Boer republics, who were in a kind of ill-defined zone, a political twilight zone. If they didn't accept British client status, they were also denied rights under international law, just as the black chiefs had been. What was making the British colonial office more jumpy was that the Boer republics were seeking recognition from the new German Empire. And so it was, the long, intricate tendrils of international diplomacy stretched all the way into the heart of Southern Africa. Within the labyrinthian confines of Carnarvon's noggin, the disparate threads of colonial policy, shifting alliances, and the burgeoning crisis of the Langalibalele uprising twisted and swirled, coalescing into a single complex Jordan knot of imperial ambition and concern. A few documents had begun to gather amongst the usual detritus of a colonial secretary's desk. Petitions from the merchants of Kimberley and Hopetown, all neatly countersigned by Governor Barclay of the Cape. Lying amongst his inbox paperwork was an additional petition from the Port Elizabeth Chamber of Commerce. All urged him to annex a place they had charmingly dubbed Butlapinia, the home of the Butlaping people, who had owned most of the land in which some of the diamonds were discovered, and were now facing the Boer republics, the Transvaal and the Free State, threatening to seize their valuable property. If the Transvaal went ahead and moved across what was known as the Keet Award Line to seize the Butlaping land, it would disrupt Griqualand West's trade and labour supply routes to Port Elizabeth. Still, Carnarvon hesitated, believing the invitation to annex Butlapinia, in his words, was even less inviting than annexing Fiji. Carnarvon admitted that the Boers of the Transvaal and the Free State had legitimate grievances following Britain's annexation of Griqualand West, but he thought Confederation would solve everything. Coming soon, another inevitable conference in Europe, this time the London Conference of 1876, which was touted as a preamble to Confederation in South Africa. President Brandt of the Free State didn't bother to pitch up. He was too busy putting together an agreement of his own with Portugal to build a railway line to Delagoa Bay. Funding the line would be the Netherlands. Britain was being shunted away, if you excuse the pun. Boers had complained for decades that the rates that the Cape and Eastern Cape merchants and port officials were charging were exorbitant. These inland farmers had developed that million-pound debt, as you've heard, so one of the obvious solutions was to export goods via their own railway through the eastern port of Delagoa Bay. By building the line, they'd simultaneously free themselves from the tyranny of the accursed English. The direction of the Boer republics was clear: to escape from economic dependence on the coastal colonies by collaborating with foreign governments, and thus seal off the increasingly valuable South African interior. Of course, this was all before gold was discovered. It was still a substantial threat to British interests, both financial and geopolitical. As Carnarvon nibbled on his colonial confederation pencil, news broke out of an additional commercial treaty between Portugal and the Orange Free State, which caused the British colonial office to panic. They felt the territory was now slipping away at speed. When the treaty was read, it elicited even more of a panicky response. Buried in one of the paragraphs was a specific reference to ships of the Orange Free State plying the seas. The attempt to challenge the mighty English on the high seas was too much. The Free State still has no coast, and historians believe the document was a cut-and-paste job, an exact copy of an earlier treaty signed 3 months before between Portugal and the Transvaal Republic. And there, the access of the Transvaal Republic to the coast could very well be secured via the northern Zululand region or even through Delagoa Bay. So Transvaal Republic ships were theoretically possible, but Free State ships? Those were another matter. Nevertheless, there were calls for a British naval cruiser to be sent to patrol South Africa's waters. In the midst of all this hullabaloo, Transvaal President Burger declared war on Petty Chief Sekhukhune. Talk about bad timing. What happened next is for a future episode. First, We must return to the diamond fields because things were moving fast at De Beers Farm. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for a little newsletter. Until next, au revoir.